The Starbucks Pistachio Latte will transport you to your happy place. The comforting flavor of pistachio, warm espresso, and milk, all with a brown buttery topping, make today a good day. Order ahead on the Starbucks app.
Welcome to the What's Back Pages podcast. I'm Barney Hoskins, and on my computer screen, I can see Mark Pringle.
Hi, Barney.
And I can see Jasper Murison Bowie.
Hello, Barney.
I can also see our very special guest, James Fox. Welcome.
Hi, Barney. Thank you.
Lovely to have you here. Well, we'll be talking to James about his long and illustrious career as a journalist and author, particularly his long association with Keith Richards, whose splendid autobiography, Life, he essentially wrote. But we'll also be talking inevitably about the late Little Richard and about soul singer Betty Wright, who we lost this week, as well as about Pete Seeger and Folkways Records. But let's start, James, by asking you, you know, how you got into this writing racket in the first place.
Well, the earliest writing racket, journalism, words.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, the wonderful emotional day. I had a summer job on some newspaper and I went down to the print room and saw these great rolling...
You know, where are we at this point? Where is this?
We're in London. I get a job on The Observer.
The Observer print room. I've been there. The old one by the river.
The old one by the river.
Yes. In fact, my band was photographed in there once, Barney.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, hilarious.
Just after they'd closed, after they'd moved The Observer to the what became the up on the Gray's Inn Road. All the machines were still in there. It's an amazing place.
Yeah. Now, well, you see, you get an emotional hit from this thing.
Yes.
The smell of the ink, the thing, and I thought that's for me. Terrible, terrible.
Just the ink that did it.
So then I went to, I got a job on the Manchester Evening News, which was a real hard school, and they didn't like me because I came from the smoke. And I vividly remember my first day on the newsroom with them saying, producing my first copy about some ambulance chasing story, which is only about four lines. A silence fell over the newsroom as the news editor asked this kid from the smoke, is that the sort of rubbish you write down in the smoke, son? And I said, excuse me, Mr. Brown. He said, you heard what I said. He said, go back and do it again. So, you know, they would clatter back to work again. So that was my initiation. I then went to Africa, worked on newspapers there, especially in the end on Drum magazine, which was the extraordinary African magazine that came out of the townships and everything. That was a great experience.
James, how did you come to go to Africa? Did they send you there, essentially?
No, I was sort of really starry-eyed and kind of a pinko, rosy liberation theologist at the age of 12 or something, you know. So off I go. I got a job on some sort of scheme or something, or word of mouth, on the Daily Nation in Nairobi. And I was very much for, you know, new Africa, freedom, all that stuff. So I worked there, and then I drove to Johannesburg. I got a job on the Rand Daily Mail through my contacts. I was pretty young. I was still 20.
Wow.
21.
Yeah.
And this was the big anti-apartheid newspaper. And then I got a call from Jim Bailey, who was the proprietor of Drum magazine, all over Africa. It wasn't just South Africa, it was Nigeria, it was Ghana, saying, come and work for us. And that was the most amazing gig that you could possibly have.
I had a book of kind of reissues of Drum magazine. It's absolutely astonishing. They covered things like the Sharpeville Massacre and all this sort of stuff. Really good photographers and people working for it. It was kind of a bit like Life magazine, but for Black Africa, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It had photo essays and...
And the extraordinary thing is that it was doing this into the teeth of apartheid and the police state, so that, you know, you've got these exposés of prisons and so on, and they let it go, I think, because they thought, we've got to know what's going on. This is almost the only way we can find out, is through this magazine.
Did you get in trouble at all?
I got into serious trouble, and I was very reckless. Actually, my experience on the Manchester Evening News, where you just don't come back without a story, had been sort of... I thought this is what you had to do. So we had the townships at our disposal. And it was incredible. The stories from this place were amazing. And I tumbled in there and I got seriously involved with some gangsters in Fordsburg, and which is a sort of what they call coloured township just near Johannesburg. Right. And I have to say, to remember that period, there was a special branch man for every civilian. I mean, it was enormous. It was like the Stasi. It was, you know, all the reporters on the Rand Daily Mail in the newsroom had a counterpart at, you know, the next desk. It was working for the special branch. So nothing. And they thought I was very suspicious because I had a Kenya registration plate. I had an American passport and so on.
Because you were born in America, weren't you?
I was born in America. So they did arrest me for going in a township without a pass, doing my normal reporting, and put me in the slammer, which was the most terrifying experience I've still to this day ever had, because they locked me up with these two Africana meth drinking guys who really didn't like me.
I think you could have just left it at meth drinking Africana guys.
they really didn't like me, and they threatened to kill me all night. It was terrifying, you know. And I you couldn't connect to them. If they'd actually, you know, beaten the shit out of me, there would have been no way I could have got in touch with them because the bell didn't work. Anyway, finally, after two or three days, they released me. But that was and I was kicked out in the end. They let me go, as it were. And I got a job on the Sunday Times magazine in these wonderful years when a lot of money, a lot of talent, a lot of photographers, a lot of great stories. And I went everywhere from Vietnam to all over Africa and so on and wrote stories.
Fantastic.
Including two of the pieces that we're featuring this week, James, which, I mean, I'm guessing sort of took you outside your normal kind of remit. They're essentially two pieces about the Rolling Stones. And the first of them focuses almost exclusively on Keith, whose extraordinary autobiography you later worked on with him. And I know you've written, the other piece, in fact, there are two other pieces we're featuring this week. One we're just adding as a new library piece, but they're both about African music, directly and tangentially. We may talk about that in a moment. Aside from when you wrote that piece about Keith in 73, had you written much? How did you come to write that piece about the Stones and visit them?
I came to write the piece. Well, I was a kind of general writer. I was a feature writer on the Sunday Times magazine. And I played the guitar. I mean, I've always played the guitar since the age of 12, almost. And I was fascinated by the guitar. And to the point where I wanted to work out how Keith played. Yeah. I couldn't work it out. How did he get this sound? Nobody else was playing. I knew all the blues players. I knew all this stuff I could play. And so I said to the Sunday Times, you know, it's time that, you know, I did a piece, and they loved the idea of a piece about the Rolling Stones because it was all about drugs. And if you could get the drugs in and Mick Jagger in, then you could get a piece. So I'm going to go and see Keith Richards. I didn't say I'm going to ask him how he plays the guitar. And they'd sort of almost never heard of Keith Richards. They'd heard of Mick Jagger, but he'd never been interviewed. He was too frightening. He was like, you know, you couldn't really approach him. He was like this terrifying kind of crow with a missing tooth, sort of black. And anyway, I tracked him down to a rehearsal hall in Rotterdam, I think, and said very timidly and tentatively, I'd like to ask you how you play the guitar, Keith. And he said, oh, I can tell you about that. He was in the middle of a deal. He had sort of money coming out of his pockets. He was counting it and, you know, his hair. And...
What kind of a deal, James?
Well, in those days, I would use euphemisms. Like I would say he was crushing aspirins under his
I read that, but I thought, oh, yeah.
Hooray, somebody picked it up.
Yeah. Oh, dear.
So there was a lot of that going on. And then he told me, and, you know, I knew exactly what he was talking about, and he said, this is how I do it. It was a total revelation, fascinating, you know, real innovation. And this piece came out called The Sound of the Stones, which you've got now in the archive. And it had a funny effect. People thought, fuck, why didn't I think of doing that? So everyone started writing pieces about how you play. Some very lame pieces came out about, you know, famous trombonists and how they, you know, how they did
it. But I love the idea that you kind of you go there and the paper imagines you're going to come back with a sort of big story and a lot of Mick Jagger and all that, and you come back and you're talking about the open G tuning and five string guitars and how many guitars he's got and his guitar tech. What's his name? Newman Jones.
Newman Jones III.
With a snakeskin hat. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
I mean, you know, what did the editor say when he presented them with that?
I think they were sort of thrilled to get some sort of inside description of what the Stones were up to instead of, you know, the non-interview with Mick Jagger. People kept on trying to interview Mick Jagger. It never worked.
Yeah, yeah, that's actually right. I mean, it's interesting because the two pieces we're running, the first one's in 73, which I think certainly Barney and I regard as the tail end of the best period of the Rolling Stones.
They were still alive. They were still pretty awesome.
They were fantastic live at that point. Then the second piece is from 76. And Barney, you and I, we both went to the Earls Court show.
Well, it's just on the... It's fascinating for us just because it's just on the eve of that week of Earls Court shows. And, you know, I mean, you're already kind of hinting in the piece that they're not exactly firing on all cylinders as a performing outfit. What I wanted to just pick up on, so that piece, I mean, it really is a remarkable piece, the earlier piece, because you didn't even get pieces like that in the music press. And it ties in with what was so fantastic about Life, the book, was where, I mean, so many people have told me about, just as that there's about three or four pages of just solid, it's like that bit in this article, The Sound of the Stones, just kind of blown up. It's four or five pages of Keith just talking about tunes, talking about guitar. And it's just an example of what made that book so outstanding, because it really was about, it was about music, and it was talking to a man who, you know, yes, he's infamous and scary and all of the things that you've alluded to, but at heart this is a man, he's just an absolutely dyed-in-the-wool musician. And the book was so much about music, it was about lots of other stuff. But so can you connect these pieces with the book and tell us how that nice little gig came about?
Yeah, well, you've really put your finger on it, because Keith, one thing he can do is communicate about music, and he thinks about it all the time, and that's his thing. And that went all the way through the book. And he communicated, in a sense, you said what leapt out of that Sunday Times piece, you know, how did you get a piece across with open G tuning? When they did the extracts from the book 30 years later, that was the bit the Times chose to extract. And this is for readers who know nothing about the guitar, nothing about music, but somehow the sort of passion comes through in a very strange way. So I wrote that piece and we became friends, a friendship forged, I have to say, on the anvil of pharmaceutical and
crushed
other,
aspirin. Crushed aspirin.
which did me no good at all. And in those days, it was a sort of cottage industry. I mean, it was a suitcase at Heathrow and stuff, and, you know, prime, you know, stuff. You could stay up for 6 days on this stuff.
We're still talking about aspirins.
Still talking about aspirins. I shouldn't. This is a family show, I know, and I couldn't talk to you about
it. I'm not sure about that. But,
but anyway, so we kept in touch over the years, and we obviously got on, you know, and whenever he came to London, we'd meet up, and one day I had a sort of one of those rock dreams where I've actually got a photograph taken of him and Patty. He'd just taken up with Patty.
Yeah.
We're flying into Wembley for a concert, just me, Keith, and Patty in a chopper, right? Doesn't happen to every...
No.
Never happened to us.
And it's Batman.
It's only never happened to me.
You're floating above Wembley Stadium, which is already full of people. There's already sound coming up, waves of heat and sound coming up from this place. And then you sort of hover down onto this thing and run across the grass. Like, it's quite extraordinary. But the corollary to it is there was a train strike that day, and I missed the connection back, and I walked back the whole way from Wembley to my house in London, having taken
flew
the
in
chopper.
And walked back. This is
a lovely juxtaposition. I like it.
I love it. As your friendship with him, in a certain, we could say that it's good to see you alive, because quite a few people who got quite close to Keith didn't make it out the other side.
Well, I didn't see that much of Keith, but we kept in touch, and also I knew that from my first meetings with Keith, that he was a really good storyteller.
Yeah.
A really good sort of economy of phrase, and he remembered everything. And his memory is a very particular kind of memory, which is, it's rather like a really good novelist. He can remember what he felt then, you know, and accurately what he felt then. There's no filter, you know. And so for something like describing the early tours with Little Richard, you know, for example, it's still very, very vivid. And so I kept on persuading him, we've got to get these stories down. I didn't say, I want to write the book. I said, you've got to get these stories down. They are the great musical stories. Yeah. And eventually his manager, Jane Rose, thought the time was right. And so I was on, but this was years later.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
One story, I mean, he talks about that, what's that extraordinary German couple of sort of like high-class, hipster, vaguely political, the ones who I believe Peter Green took the acid trip, which put him over the edge at their castle, and so on and so forth. And it's like he's met the whole world at some stage in his life, Keith has. And he sort of like just pulls them all in. It's extraordinary.
He does. He does. But never does he lose this awe of musicians and music. He could never be drawn aside like that. That's why, actually, in the book, when he complains about Jagger, it's because mm-hmm. Jagger does that. And he seems to sort of, you know, he's, first of all, it's a friendship that he thought was very, very special. But also, if anything broke away from the love of this band and the making of music, he just couldn't take it. He just, yeah. you know, furious, basically.
Yeah.
I love the story of, so I think it's in the second of the pieces, the story about how they came to call themselves the Glimmer Twins.
Oh, yeah.
Which, I mean, I never knew or had forgotten, but 1968, they're on a boat in Brazil with
a
bunch of upper-class English people.
Yes,
the
upper-class
English people. The kind of people that Mick wanted to be around,
that's right. And they're sort of swathed in these sort of, you know, some sort of tropical thing, or looking like Catherine Hepburn or something, and they're on this boat. And they're just driven mad by these long hairs, these sort of people, and they were keeping to themselves the Stones. And finally, this woman said, "Oh, go on. What do you do? What are you doing? How do you do it? I mean, what's going on? Oh, go on, give us a glimmer. Just a glimmer." And they said, "Okay, you know, Glimmer Twins is perfect. It works."
Yeah. It's fantastic.
In the first piece, it's very interesting that it's a year after Exile being recorded in France at Keith's place. And quite a lot of the piece is actually about the beginning of the separation of the members of the band. Whereas you say in the piece about how, well, you're told that Keith and Mick would spend three nights together in one of their houses and come out with songs, and that had all gone, that each would bring their components. So it's sad, is that sort of the roots of, well, the divisions within the band are sort of becoming apparent even in 1973. And in retrospect, it's very sad to read because, I mean, Barney and I just love that 68 to 72 period Rolling Stones. I mean, for us, that's the greatest rock and roll band in the world.
Rock and roll ever.
I
ever
quite agree with you. I agree with you there. Although it hammers along.
Yeah. You say, I think somewhere in that first piece, you allude to the fact that in the Stones camp, no one thinks very much of Exile on Main Street. And they've just recorded they've just finished Goat's Head Soup in Jamaica, which is, I mean, a markedly inferior record. But it's interesting how long it took for people to realise how great Exile was.
It's interesting that, isn't it? It's musically so fascinating. It's such a breakthrough. It's got so many new stuff in it and so on.
Yeah.
I still think it'd be a better single LP.
We won't get into that.
I'll hold to that. You know, but it is great. But I think,
But you put your finger on something there, because remember Graham Parsons was around a lot at that time, which must have made a division. I mean, Keith just attached himself completely to Graham at that time.
Yeah,
he started writing.
One of the things I think is interesting about both of the pieces is that a sort of introspective Keith comes across in a way that's unusual for him. I think maybe what you say about him not being interviewed because people were scared, but he sort of muses on why Mick Jagger feels he'll never be accepted as a musician and this sort of thing, and in quite a sort of generous and sympathetic sort of way, which isn't necessarily what one might expect from, you know, Keith Richards.
I thought it was a sly dig at Jagger, actually. But
I didn't read it as a dig.
Okay,
actually,
okay.
But later, I mean, in your book, I mean...
Yeah, well, infamously, yes. Well, James will know, tell us about sly digs at Jagger and that very, that complicated relationship between the Glimmer
Twins.
Well,
you must, at the base of all this, you've got Dartford and the train and you've got Jagger, and he's an only child. And one of the introspections that Keith has about himself is what it's like being an only child, how you have to make alliances, how difficult it is. The alliances come and go. And if you got one, you hold on to it, and it's crucial to you. And he got one with Mick, and they were together. They were inseparable, you know, and they did everything together. Remember that in the early, in the 63, the time they met, they were on tour with Little Richard, they did about 1,000 shows back to back. They did something like, was it 3 years without stopping? Barely, you know, this is really close stuff. So there comes this moment of, I don't know what happens. Mick's head is turned. Something happens. He sees himself in some of, but Keith feels a sense of betrayal. He feels some sense of betrayal of sort of friendship or drifting away, a terrible sadness. Mm. And when it is then compounded by Mick making fatal remarks like, the Rolling Stones is a millstone round my neck. Mm-hmm. This will be a sort of moment when you can't restrain Keith in his book from saying exactly what he thinks. You shouldn't have gone off and done this music. You almost broke the band up. You know, I really mind about it and so on. People thought it was, you know, he shouldn't have said it. It was unfair and so on. But actually, it within that world and within the Rolling Stones band, all the people that know Keith, if he hadn't said that, they would have thought he had copped out because it was such a big story inside the band of how bad relations were, you know.
Yeah. I take it you were aware of that the journalist Bill Wyman wrote this spoof letter that Mick wrote in response, which is actually very, very funny.
Oh, I haven't seen that.
It's online. You've got to, we'll send you a link to it. It's very funny. It's like Mick's just read the book and he's having a go back at Keith. Well, you know, I was the guy who held you upright on stage for the last sort of 15 years. And
yeah, well, there is a bit of toing and froing necessary there, obviously, yeah.
Yeah, but it's good. I mean, I love it. Slightly unfortunate name, Bill Wyman, not that Bill Wyman, you know. But he wrote this thing, I think just as a joke, but it had a certain sort of resonance.
Credibility.
On the subject of Bill Wyman, he was always incredibly funny, Keith. I remember him saying, I couldn't understand why Bill Wyman, he had all these girls waiting downstairs, you know, and they were sent up every 10 minutes. And he said, they'd come upstairs and have a milky cup of tea with Bill Wyman. You know, what did he say to them? You know, do you come from round here? And the other great story I loved, we were in a press conference in Paris. There were six journalists. There was me sort of by now sitting beside Keith in case he went back to these libelous stories, which I'd raked out of the book, such as, yes, when I first met Johnny Depp, I thought he was Marlon's drug dealer, you know. So Keith, no, we've been through that. He appeared on the front page of Sunday. Anyway, one of the journalists said, Mr. Richard, I can't see very much about with Bill Wyman in this book. Did you want to exclude him or something? And he said, the reason for that is that Bill's not very interesting.
By the way, you've got Keith down absolutely spot
on. Wonderful impression.
I held back before I...
No, we're going to have to get a bit more of Keith out of you because it's one of the best. It's not actually that easy a voice to imitate, but you've spent enough time with the man to practically by osmosis.
Well, he got a little touchy about that, actually.
And, you didn't.
And it got back to him that I was going around sort of telling these marvellous anecdotes in Keith speak. And so he said to me... I'll tell you something, James. One day you're going to get your personality back.
I've interviewed Keith a couple of times, and I think anyone who has, and you're the front of that queue, really, is the thing that is so surprising when you come with all your preconceptions is what a sweet and humble man he is, you know. He really genuinely, he's sort of so different from Jagger. Jagger's sort of always somehow performing. And with Keith, you just sort of get this guy who, he wouldn't be any different if he hadn't become the most famous, you know, junkie rock and roll rhythm guitar player on the planet. You kind of feel he'd be the same guy.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. And in fact, what I was saying about the memory is like that. You know, the fame and stuff hasn't broken or altered the hasn't put a filter on this memory. So when he talks about Little Richard, he talks about those early days, he talks about how he wasn't a very good guitar player at the time, but he thought the band was quite good, you know, and what awe he had of, you know, Little Richard and why and all this kind of stuff, which is still absolutely fresh.
We will be talking about Little Richard. It's fantastic. His name's come up a few times already. And we will, just before that, I just want to mention, obviously, probably this is your best-selling book, White Mischief, which is an extraordinary book about the white upper classes in Kenya, because it was made into a movie, White Mischief, and just tying it in with the fact that we have these two great pieces that are a world away from Keith Richards and the Stones, and they're really wonderful. One of them is about the cult of the sappers in Africa, in the Congo, and the other one is a piece that's going in straight to the library, which is about the kora players of Mali and this lost singer that you track down called Fanta Sako. It's tremendous. Did all your African experiences, in a sense, sort of lead to this? Because I was reminded that it sort of started life as early as 1969 with the help of the legendary Cyril Connolly, James. So just tell us what the germ of the book was.
Well, the germ of the book was that Cyril Connolly, I was on the Sunday Times magazine, I was a feature writer, and Cyril Connolly was on the paper. He was the book reviewer, came in once a week with his copy. And he was also a neighbor of my parents in the country, in Sussex. And we had a series called Unsolved Mysteries. And I said to Cyril one day, he came to lunch at my mother's house, and I said, is there anything you could write, any unsolved mystery that's been on your mind? And he said, he's always been fascinated by the murder of Lord Errol and Dels Broughton, because he knew some of the characters. So we collaborated. I mean, me, the young, I was 23, 24. Put up against Connolly, this great man of letters. And we investigated this thing and we wrote a piece called Christmas at Carn, which came out in 1969 and 1970. And then he died and he left me all his papers. And I just thought, I'll turn this into a book. And I went further. I actually sort of solved the mystery, I think I did. But with that little glimmer of doubt that keeps it all going for ages.
Yeah.
It's always good policy. So that took me into, I'd already been in reporting in Africa, and actually I had come across this story, or maybe I told Cyril about it, because when I was on the Daily Nation, this story was always around, because Lady Delamere, who was the sort of chief character in that story, was still there, landed this woman, this sort of femme fatale, this woman seen stalking around the Mathega Club in her jewels. And I suggested, I remember, to the news editor, why don't we do a piece about that? And he said, don't touch that story, We don't touch that. Shut down. So when I came back, this intrigued me. So I, and on it went. So then I went back to Kenya to research it, and the book eventually came. It was an extraordinary experience. How it leads to African music, I was supposed to be the Southern African correspondent at one point of the Sunday Times, and I did go a lot to Southern Africa because I'd been there as a journalist and stuff. And I think when I first went to the Zaire, the Congo, and heard this soukous music, it just took me completely by the short and scruff. I just couldn't believe this fabulous rumba music. It was in every bar. It was in these wonderful places with the neon light. And it was even the official music. Mobutu had nationalized all the bands because they were so powerful. He had to have them playing for the government because it was too much of a rival.
Wow.
So I got onto that, and then I met, I'd always known Lucy Duran, who's a great friend of mine, who now teaches African music at SOAS and speaks Mandinka and plays the kora. And we fell in to this world of African string playing. And that opened up a world to me of such total magic. The contrast between the sort of colonial world of the white settlers in Kenya and this underground world of the African culture and the music was totally fascinating to me. So I traveled a lot with Lucy. We tracked down this singer called Fanta Sako, who's got, I think, the most beautiful voice I've heard, really. She's so beautiful. And on it went. And we brought over, we encouraged early kora players to come to London. They played in my house. Guests gave money to them. We nurtured them. So I became very friendly with these guys, very close to them, and went to stay in their compound in Gambia and became very good friends with one called Dembo Conte, who I had a very close friendship with. And he said to me one day, we really get on well, you and I. We should really be married, except there'd be this problem.
That's so funny.
Just say to our listeners that, yes, that James was flicking two fingers
against each other.
Against bang, each bang, other. Bang.
Yes. Just it was fairly clear what he meant. But
yeah, but I thought that was so sweet. I thought that was a term of endearment, you know.
Yeah.
That's fabulous. James, I know we could talk for hours and hours, and sadly we're going to have to move on to someone, as I say, you've already mentioned, Little Richard, who died, a week or so ago, 10 days ago? I mean, this was one of the absolute giants, and it's really hard to know where we start. And then I will just preface our brief discussion about Richard Penham. So many tributes have been paid over the last week, 10 days. I thought, let's just do something slightly different. And actually, this tremendous writer, Ed Jones, just got in touch with us, didn't he, Mark? And he sent us these two terrific pieces from 1975, which are a sort of different side of the Little Richard story. He's touring in Europe, and it's a complete fiasco. And there is angry teddy boys booing him because he hasn't got saxophonists, and telling him to get rid of that drummer. And yeah, I mean, they're remarkable.
No, and he's the poor guy who's promoted this tour. Little Richard is making his life an utter misery, demanding to fly first class, to be upgraded hotels, all out of this promoter's pocket.
He loses his shirt on the tour completely, James.
But they aren't long pieces. The first one's a sort of 500-word live review, and the second one's slightly longer. But you put them together, and it's absolutely fantastic glimpse of Little Richard in his particular madness at that particular point in his career.
As is the Vernon Gibbs piece from The Village Voice in 1982, when Richard is reinventing himself not entirely reinvented himself because it's always been part of his makeup, but he's become a preacher and he's preaching in this little church in Brooklyn and essentially railing against his own homosexuality.
Whilst being as camp as anything in the process.
Yeah.
So at one point, the woman sitting next to Vernon says, he's still a homosexual.
Yeah, you know, I'll bet he's still a homosexual.
Vernon's a fantastic writer. I'm really glad we got him on board. He's a rare thing in the 70s as an African-American music writer. There weren't many of them around. And he's such a stylish writer. And so he's in this church. Is it Brooklyn or something?
Brooklyn.
Yeah, Brooklyn. And Richard is just camping it up like mad. And the thing is, the audience are responding with laughter. And then Richard says, don't laugh, you know, I'm telling you this truth. And then he's mincing again. I mean, it's absolutely, it's brilliant. It's mad.
Did you know about his meeting with Tom Jones down in Wales? Keith told me the story, which, of course, those Teds down in Wales, they were super Teds. They were all dressed up.
Teds. Yeah, they were uber Teds.
They knew the whole thing. And they worshipped Little Richard. He went down there. And Keith tells a story that they went to his dressing room. Somewhere like that.
Gaumont in Cardiff or something?
Yeah, I think that's right. And then, so they got into these, Tom Jones and his friends got into Little Richard's dressing room and had this tremendous reverence. And he was a god. So they kneeled down in front of Little Richard, who went, boys, oh, my little Georgia peaches.
Oh, fantastic. The other thing is, Barney, you're talking about the stage in his career where he's in church. Well, Vernon Gibbs says brilliantly in this, he says he's been born again so often, he's getting younger. I just love this. Because he just bounced back and forth, didn't he, throughout his entire life. And stuff comes out, you know, stories which we didn't know back then about him and Buddy Holly and the Crickets on tour, where basically, you know, he would just sit there and watch Buddy Holly shagging whoever Buddy Holly was shagging. Voyeurism was a big thing.
And
really, that's so interesting.
Well, I remember him. So we've actually got a clip of Richard from the interview that I did with him in 85. He did a lot of interviews in 85 because his autobiography came out. And there's quite a lot about voyeurism in that. Shall we just hear the inimitable tones of Richard Penniman?
Let's.
Toot-a-toot, oh, rude. Toot-a-toot, woo, toot-a-toot-a. I was Alpha 4 Elvis, and I was black, and they didn't let my things through. You understand me? I was with RCA Victor before Elvis, but it was Camden when he was black, and if he was white, they called it RCA Victor. And it was when I came on the scene, it was Swing and Sway with Sammy Kaye. I couldn't swing and I couldn't sway, so I rocked. I am the king of rock and roll. I'm one of the most imitated artists ever lived. In the world, Prince is me, Michael is me, in this generation, David Bowie, he tells he's me.
No false modesty from Little Richard, bless him.
Also, I didn't realize he was so camp. I hadn't heard his
voice. He was in interview, he was as camp as you could hope for, really.
Right.
I mean, I really feel, obviously, I'm too young to have heard him the first time round. My brother bought this double A-side on the English London Records, Reissue of Good Golly, Miss Molly and Lucille. And it just pinning me to the wall. I'd never heard anything quite like that before.
Yeah.
You know, and in retrospect, it was also, he's my gateway drug to New Orleans R&B because his stuff was mostly recorded in New Orleans, wasn't it, Barney?
Yeah.
Kazima Matassas with Dave Bartholomew and those guys.
Yeah.
For me, he's my favourite rock and roller of that generation.
The first record Keith bought was Long Tall Sally, I think.
Yeah. Was it? Was it indeed? I mean, Tutti Frutti, you'd have to say, probably is the birth of rock and roll. And I think when you kind of revisit the Little Richard story, what you realize it was a sort of a fabulous accident in a way. I don't think he intended to become the sort of camp king of and queen of rock and roll. Because he was very much in the mold of the sort of jump blues kind of R&B guys. He was signed to Peacock. When you listen to his early stuff, it ain't Tutti Frutti, it ain't Long Tall Sally. And he's sitting there one day in, I guess, Cosimo Matassa's studio in New Orleans, and he just starts kind of doing with that explosion, and it's kind of like the big bang of rock and roll.
But the song is all about anal gay sex.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Dave Bartholomew prevails on him to change some of the words.
Isn't it the most perfect thing that the birth of rock...
The Big Bang is such a brilliant idea. It was a big bang. It was
a big bang.
Absolutely.
There was a wonderful piece, really interesting piece in The Guardian yesterday by a sort of genuine rock academic who's a professor of American studies at Yale, black writer Tavia Nyong'o. And it's very, very woke piece called The Tutti Frutti Crew. And it's just exploring how, it's basically making the point very eloquently that rock and roll was essentially fashioned by a gay black man.
It's a great story, really.
Yeah,
it's a fantastic story.
But also the place of the church and all of that. That part
the
of that
Reverend,
piece
gets, yeah.
talks about that. Well, you know that black all American church. Expression is so linked to the church, to the black American church. I mean, the one thing I think she missed in that piece is she should have mentioned Sylvester, who in a sense had a very similar path, who grew up in the churches like Little Richard did. And took that with him into his disco, into his very gospel-y disco sort of stuff, you know.
Sure.
Anyway, I just love.
I mean, I think without Little Richard, I think we can safely say, you know, we might not have had the Stones at all. We might not have had, you know, the rock and roll side of the Beatles. You know, Paul McCartney was literally taught to scream by Little Richard. So
tutorials.
Yeah, they're on YouTube now.
Hello, welcome to my screaming tutorial.
Yeah. So you know, farewell, Richard Penniman, yeah. without whom...
I'm amazed he lived as long as he did.
He did, he lived a long time. He lived in the Hyatt House. And I know lots of people had the experience of going up in the lift at the Hyatt House on Sunset with Little Richard, who lived at the top. I only went up once in that lift with all his luggage. I think he'd just come back from Las Vegas. And there's this, all these sort of furs and suits.
When my band was recording Muscle Shoals, we were being looked after by a guy called Monkey Wamack, who was Travis Wamack's son. And he and his dad were part of Richard's band at that time.
Yes.
And they just loved him, you know. Mm-hmm. And they said, and they all called him Richard, you know.
Yes.
Like, oh, we call him Richard. And I said, what do you call him? Do you call him Little or,
yeah. said,
or Mr. Penniman? You know, they said, no, we call him Richard.
Richard
and they adored him.
Yeah, yeah.
And the music is still just electrifying.
Oh,
you listen
fantastic.
To it now and it's just yeah. exactly that jumping out of it. It's amazing. Mary, John, he claimed he had the music, but he had a lot of fun, oh, baby.
we probably have to talk about Betty Wright,
yes,
Mark, because
yes,
we've lost her too, and we're all big, big fans of Betty Wright. Clean Up Woman, one of the most unique and extraordinary classic soul singles from the 70s.
Absolutely fantastic. Shura Shura was a kind of minor hit in this country when it came out, and I loved it. Knew nothing about its provenance, had no idea that it had been written by Alan Toussaint and so on and so forth. And then years later, I became a fan of this band called Rugulator. I had this guitar player called Danny Adler, who had this sort of rhythm lead style that he did. And a friend of mine said, if you like that, you've got to listen to Clean Up Woman. Listen to Little Beaver's guitar playing on that record. You know, it's three guitar parts. And so I got it as a 7-inch single, and this is fantastic. Then about a few months later, I was working in a bookshop in Charing Cross Road, and over the road was R Price Records, and they had a big remaindered record section, stuff from America, probably Morris Levy's.
All the cutouts, the cutouts.
They had all these records by TK on the TK label or Alston or, you know, whichever version of the label it was. And so I used to go out with armfuls of these things. So I was really getting into soul music in a big way. And there's one album, Danger High Voltage, which Shura Shura came off, which I reckon is still one of the greatest R&B albums I've ever heard.
It's a fabulous album. I love Danger High Voltage. It's so great.
I saw Betty last year at the Barbican. She was fabulous.
You know, I'm gutted because you saw it and it was a sort of midweek kind of gig and she was doing a second one the night after you'd seen her and you said how great she was, and I very nearly booked tickets and went but then didn't because they were expensive and it was the middle of the week and whatever, and I just regret so much not having gone to see that gig.
Betty Wright,
and she is fabulous. She's 17 when Clean Up Woman came out, but she had been singing professionally since about 13 or 14, again out of the church. Again in 86 she had a minor hit with a song called Pain, which was just fantastic.
Yeah.
And then after that she produced a couple of Joss Stone albums. She did a fabulous album, The Roots, in 2012.
Yeah,
2011, I think. Yeah,
which is almost as good as anything she'd done in her career. She never stopped.
No, like Little Richard, she did. She sort of went back to God, didn't she?
Yeah.
We've got a little clip of her, not actually talking about God, but it's just a love. It just shows what a wonderful, exuberant, gorgeous person she was. So let's just hear that.
I'm more into live performance and recording. I think it's because I'm a people person, and in recording studios, you got about three people, and I'm a ham. You know how I just come alive when I see a lot of people, the more the better. I just show off. You know, some people are just born ostentatious by nature. And that's me, you know, I have to be center stage, and I pass that to my baby. God help.
Oh, that's so fabulous.
She's got a young child at this point. I love that. I've passed to my baby. God help her.
It's great. She comes off so wonderfully.
She's just fabulous. Yeah. So
do you remember Clean Up Woman, James? Do you remember that record, Clean Up Woman?
I don't. Actually, Gap.
Go listen to it.
Now I do. I will go.
Yeah. And Danger High Voltage as well. Mark said it.
That one you were talking
about. Yeah. She's absolutely fabulous.
What's shocking, I mean, I'm 64. She was only 66 when she died last week. 66. And to think that I was still at school when her records are coming out. I mean, that's absolutely terrifying.
So you've got two years to make a record as good as Clean Up Woman, Mark.
It's too late. ain't going to happen.
No. Well, so we have two pieces about Betty, and one of them is from 77, one of them is by John Swenson, one is Frank Owen talking to her in 86 when Pain, the record Pain, has just come out. Yeah. It's time, Mark, to talk about this week's audio interview.
Yes, absolutely. Let me just shrink my screen so I can see my notes. Exit full screen. That's the one.
Is this all going to be in the episode?
Absolutely. It's all going to be in the episode.
This is vital social documented history.
Yeah. I mean, this is a really, really, really good interview. I thought it was going to be an interview about Pete Seeger. It's not. It's Pete Seeger's memories of the rather splendid Moses Ash, who ran what became Folkways Records. And he talks about Mo's business practices, why Mo did this, Mo did that. And, well, we'll listen to a clip. He talks about how Mo's goal was to document music. You know, that some academic would go to Africa, come back with a tape of sort of thing you're talking about, James, you know, precisely. And he'd put it out on Folkways, really well presented with brochures, with properly written documentation. And, you know, he'd never remove a record from catalogue. Once a record was in a Folkways catalogue, it stayed there, even if it only sold 15 copies a year.
And they're still all available to this day.
They are.
That's incredible.
I know.
I mean, it's an amazing thing, Folkways. It's just beyond belief now, think about it.
So let's hear a clip, and then we'll talk about Folkways and Mo Ash and Pete Seeger.
And this is about the documenting of music.
I think it's a very big contribution, not just the fact that he recorded things, which any fool could say, well, that record is not going to sell. But he'd say it needs to be documented. Mm-hmm. His basic principle, mm-hmm. here is something which, if it's not documented now, mm-hmm. it'll be lost forever. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So some professor comes back from a field trip to a distant place, part of the world, and keeps playing the tapes in their classes, but it's a nuisance to have to make copies, and writes Folkways, say, would you be interested in releasing a record?
Yeah.
I don't think you'll sell many. Mo said, I can't pay you much, maybe $100, just to repay you for the cost of the tape you used, mm-hmm. and the time it'll take to put together a brochure. Mm-hmm. The brochure that went along with the Folkways record was a very important part of it.
Yeah.
Most records just came out with a few words on the back cover. And he gave a complete booklet, sometimes a big fat booklet, with the words of the song, sometimes pictures, sometimes an essay.
Yeah, I mean,
incredible.
Absolutely. He talks about Mo's business practices. I mean, we were talking about this yesterday, Barney and I, that he figured that you either stay pretty small or you get huge. There's no in-between. You'll get swallowed up. And that by working on the margins, by working in very niche areas, staying a small label, you may not make a lot of money, but you can survive to keep making the next record you want to release.
Mm. So, James, you sent me in the week this wonderful picture. I mean, I knew you had spent your early your youth in America. You were born in Washington, D.C., but you sent me this fabulous picture from, I think, 1960, if I'm correct, of you playing guitar with the Reverend Gary Davis. And so I thought, well, he must know something about Folkways. tell us just a bit about, you know, tell us how you came to be sitting there playing guitar with the Reverend Gary Davis and what your kind of involvement with that kind of Greenwich Village folk blues scene was.
Well, I mean, it's incredible. I picked up a guitar first. A school kid had one. And I, by incredible chance, my family knew Rory McEwen, the McEwen brothers, who were playing on this Tonight program. They played Topical Calypsos and they played. But Rory had been to America. He'd met Leadbelly's wife. He'd bought a 12-string. He was deep into it. Folkways had recorded him and his brother singing Scottish songs.
Oh, right.
I just jumped in. I mean, I was totally, utterly... And then I went round to Rory's house, which is in Tregunta Road near the Boltons, which was a real mecca at that time. There was a moment when folk and pop and everything, the Everly Brothers, Bob Dylan, folk, was all sort of mixed up together. It was very exciting. It was when the freewheeling Bob Dylan came out, period. I was at school. And I attached myself to Rory, who taught me how to play the 12-string. So, and I had heard Blind Boy Fuller for the first time, which is one of those moments when the air changes, the actual color, the actual sort of atoms of the air change. Life is different after this. It's never going to be the same again.
Right.
Blind Boy Fuller, Airplane Blues. I was hooked. So he'd been to New York. He knew all these people. Everyone knew Rory. People used to come back and forth in his house, and he knew Pete Seeger. The crucial thing about Folkways and Pete Seeger was that Folkways had produced a thing called Pete Seeger's Guitar Guide for Folk Singers. Key document. A record and an instruction book of how to play the guitar. And everybody, I'm sure even Bert Jantz and all these people, must have used that record for their basic thing. You've got the church lick out of it. You've got the Woody Guthrie stuff out of it. You learn to all this stuff, how to tune it and everything. And there was Pete Seeger's voice, just like that. I don't want to be churlish.
go on.
I love
nothing's ever stopped.
I mean,
you
Pete Seeger's achievements are incredible, but he was incredibly righteous.
Yes,
and out of this, you can hear it in the voice. There is a sort of righteousness there, you know. And now you think back and cringe to songs like "Where Have All the Flowers Gone" or "What Did You Learn in School Today?" And you think, "Stop being so fucking pious." You know?
Yeah, he was pious, wasn't he? And he sounds pious in this audio.
I mean, famously, he was the man who tried to take an axe to the wiring to the amplifiers backing Dylan at the Newport Festival.
Well, they say it's not true.
It's
got to be true.
That's Rashomon time again, isn't it?
It's better if it's true, so it's true. That's how it works.
Isn't that how Donald Trump thinks?
But this interview is actually really nice because in some ways, Tony Sherman, who did the interview, had heard stories about Mo Ash being, let's say, shall we say, tight with the royalties and so on and so forth, and had heard that Pete Seeger had fallen out with Mo Ash over just that. And he's not. He's incredibly generous about it. We'll listen to a clip at the very end of the show where he talks about precisely that. He says, well, you know what? I knew I was going to depend on these records. Who cares about royalties? The main thing was to make the records, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite astonishing. You talk about surviving. I don't know how he survived at all with these records. He had cost of production, you know, sell 5 copies. How many people bought McEwen Brothers singing Aberdeen folk songs?
Well, he talks in an interview about one specific thing. He said that if you're going to be small, charge more money.
Yeah, so he did charge a lot more for these records.
Each album would be, let's say, $3 more than a pop album would be.
Yeah, yeah.
But people really wanted these albums. Yeah. As you say, you're working in a niche, people will pay that little bit extra. And that was kind of what kept the thing going.
Well, you know, I mean, looking back, I think my whole education at that time, you know, what turned me into sort of my interest in journalism and so on was actually the Folkways.
Really?
Because they had things like, they had the entire southern prison system. You could read all about Parchman Farm and all that stuff, what was going up on the Brazos River. You could read about the Depression. You could read about Dust Bowl. You know, it had this incredible background. Where else were you going to get this
A history of American working people, in a sense.
Exactly. Yeah.
So, I mean, we'll listen to another clip. But he's, again, is self-deprecating about how he failed to spot the hit when Woody Guthrie did an EP, probably a 10-inch record, was entitled and included This Land Is Your Land.
That's very funny. I'm rather pleased to hear that.
Woody appreciated getting a small salary, and Mo was willing to release whatever Woody had. Mm-hmm. And at that time, Woody was writing a lot of children's songs for his own kids. Mm-hmm. So one great little record came out after another. Mm-hmm. And then came out a 10-inch LP called This Land Is Your Land. And one of the songs in it was a song that I remember thinking was one of Woody's lesser efforts. I said, so simple. So on. Well, I was sure taught a lesson. It was a triumph of simplicity.
Did Mo like that song? Do you remember when he first... Do you remember Mo's reaction to it?
Oh, well, that's why he titled the record after the song. The song was only one of a dozen songs on the record.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island.
It's a great story. Like I said, we'll listen to, I think, a fabulous clip about the royalties and so on and so forth at the end of the thing. But it's a really... Slight problem with this interview, it's quite hard to hear some of the questions because Tony Sherman was very clearly pointing the mic to the subject, which is a good thing. I really enjoyed digitising this.
Yeah, I did too. You know, and whatever one thinks about Pete and or his music, he was a man of enormous moral integrity, and you hear that. And this is not long after Moash has died, of course, and the Smithsonian has acquired the Folkways catalogue, and it still keeps the entire catalogue, as it were, in print after all these years, which is a laudable thing. And I think Tony goes up to, because Pete had this amazing house on the Hudson River, and the Hudson River became a very important part of his life and music. And it's actually, I found it absolutely fascinating. Not knowing that much about Folkways or even Woody Guthrie, I felt sort of kind of privileged to hear this, Mark.
But yeah, also, you have to remember that Pete had a lot to do with Leadbelly too.
So exactly, and he does talk about Leadbelly as well.
Which is absolutely crucial. And he does. Without Leadbelly, no Van Morrison and so on. And Leadbelly knew, I went to see Leadbelly's Widow, that one of my pilgrimages when I was 15 on that same Gary Davis trip, I went, I opened the guitar case. There was the 12 string. And I said, do you know where Gary Davis is? And she said, yeah. He's down here and you call so and so. And I went down to Greenwich Village and there he was. And we took a picture.
Fantastic.
So they all knew each other.
It's quite interesting because in a way that I mean, Leadbelly had, well, there are two things. First of all, the Lomax connection, basically being kind of inverted commas rescued, but then appallingly patronized by the elder Lomax. Is it Alan the father?
Alan.
Yeah. There's a terrible video, you can find it on YouTube, where it's Leadbelly at Alan Lomax's, and he's been basically told to dress in overalls and go yes'm, you know, to this guy. You know, Leadbelly actually wanted to dress in smart clothes and gallivant with the girls and have, you know, drink fine liquor and all that sort of stuff. He was no step and fetch it. And he resented, he fell out with Alan Lomax, actually successfully sued Alan Lomax.
Did he?
Yes, which is pretty amazing. Probably with the help of Moash.
Right. And these guys are living in New York City. Now.
Yeah,
They're not living on a plantation.
Exactly.
And it's interesting to hear Pete talk about this, like, second or third floor walk-up on the Lower East Side, I think between Avenue B and C, which is where Mr. and Mrs. Leadbelly live, you know. And I love little details like that.
I loved it, so do I, absolutely.
And so actually Leadbelly had a really good relationship with Moash, you know, a better relationship than he had with the Lomaxes.
Yes.
But anyway, it's great. Really, you know, for all you people out there, have a listen to this interview. It's really fascinating.
Great. So great, James, to get your kind of personal input on that. So fantastic. And as we always say, please stick around because Mark's going to just talk us through some of his highlights from the new library pieces this week. And just jump in if anything, you know, if the mood takes you.
First thing is, again, this new writer we've got on board, Philip Elwood, San Francisco Examiner. And he sees the classic Coltrane Quartet live in San Francisco in 1965. This is one with Jimmy Garrison, McCoy Tyner, Elvin Jones. This is like, you know, John Coltrane, great. And Philip Elwood says, the best of jazz is always a most personal and communicative musical form. Coltrane is expanding jazz outward to undefined horizons. And though the destination often seems uncertain, the way is obviously well charted in his astonishingly imaginative and creative mind. Yeah, this is great. Yeah, this is a 1965 review. This is why I love my job sometimes.
It's a nice piece of writing, that.
Yeah.
He's very good. And the second thing is uncredited, though I suspect by Disco Music Echo's house hippie Hugh Nolan. And it's a review of The Velvet Underground and Nico from 1967, which is, there aren't many reviews of The Velvet Underground and Nico.
No.
He says, their music's hard rock and roll brought up to date with electricity. An electric viola adds a distinctive, cruel, harsh note. It's particularly evil on Venus and Furs and Heroin, two of the best tracks on the album, which are never likely to get played on the BBC. Skating through up to 76, Michael Watts reviews Kate Nan and McGarrigal, the eponymous debut album from those two, and he loves it. It's a long review, it's like 1200 words, which is a long review, and he says, as far as this album is concerned, Kate's writing is slightly the more consistent perhaps, and yet Anna's Heart Like a Wheel is its centerpiece. A tender, slow bleeding song in which the lyrics and the tune are exquisitely shaped by vocals that wrap themselves around the melody. Well done, Michael Watts.
One of the most beautiful songs ever written.
I think it's wonderful too.
Do you agree, James? Yeah.
Yes, I do.
It's an absolute heartbreaker.
Heartbreak. They did good at those kind of songs. They had others. Some say hardest
just like a wheel. When you bend it, you can't mend it.
Skating through from my stuff, a very good Brian Case interview with Ian Deary and Melody Maker in 1978. And, you know, Brian Case didn't write much about kind of rock and roll, but he wrote a few times about Ian Deary. They clearly had something of a bond. And Ian Deary says, if you regard an LP as an exhibition of your work, then you only do that when you're ready to show a selection. It's about how long it takes him to kind of put records together. He compares it with what happens if you do everything too often. He says, they want to do what happened to all the good comedians like Frankie Howard. Put him on every week and suck him dry, which is, you know, I think a really fair point. Lovely is a Don Waller interview with Ashford and Simpson, which I love because there aren't many interviews with Ashford and Simpson, huge heroes of mine. David Toop in The Times in 1990 interviews Billy Idol rather sweetly. He says, that was partly the joke of calling myself Billy Idol. It was a reflection of how, in the early days of English rock, people were invented by a Svengali. Everybody's changing their names as if there was a Svengali telling you, wear leather, be Billy Idol. It was really us doing it, making fun of it, which I think is quite nice. Ice-T interviewed by Rob Tannenbaum for GQ. People say I'm violent, but an Ice-T album has its political points, it has its ghetto points, and it's also got, damn, look at her ass. And he talks about Ice Cube. He says, Ice Cube is heavy off into that Muslim shit. He doesn't like white girls and shit like that. I'm quick to tell a white girl, look, I ain't no Muslim.
See, we're not always sneeringly woke, Jasper.
And lastly, just mention there's a very good history of Acid House by Andy Kreisel for the New Musical Express in 1998, celebrating the 10 years of the second summer of love. That's my lot.
That's wonderful. Jasper, what have you got for us?
Well, I'll just mention a couple of things. First of which is a live review of Joanna Newsom, who we talked about a few weeks ago.
And whom I worship.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think she's fantastic on record. I've never seen her live, but I've seen some videos of her playing on YouTube, and she's remarkable, sort of enchanting presence. But this is a live review. Lisa Verica goes to see her at the Apollo Hammersmith and comes away thinking that it was a great gig and sums it up as, on record, Newsom may remain an acquired taste, but here she was a paralysing Pied Piper who could do as she pleased without ever coming close to breaking her own spell. Think is a nice way to sort of sum up how, you know, Joanna Newsom's music is. She's wonderful. I mean, we talked about her fairly recently, so I won't go into too much, but she's just great.
So this is all new stuff which is flooding in to your...
Yes,
flooding, indeed. James.
Flooding. Yes.
We need sandbags.
And how many years have you been out with this? There's no end.
No, I mean, this is, it's like all eternity, you know. It's sort of a kind of hell, really.
I got, via Sun, I got Philip Elwood on board, 2 weeks ago? And I've so far harvested 800 articles of his, and I've only just reached the end of 1975.
Oh, God, geez. Stop. Elwood.
So stay tuned, yeah. And then I just wanted also to mention a album review from The Wire, Neil Kulkarni reviewing JPEG Mafia's album, The Second Amendment. And JPEG Mafia is quite an interesting rapper. It's quite a dark sort of, you know, a time again for hip-hop to look beyond its normal loci of national and international significance and focus on those scenes so cut off from the mainstream that giving a fuck about crossover or success isn't just spiritually undesirable but downright impossible.
I'm a big fan of Neil's writing.
It's really great. And he's really interesting about this, you know, dark hip-hop artist, JPEG Mafia, did an album with a song called Freaky. Shit-stirring polemics, deranged noisescapes, music that hums and gurns and lurches and crashes like the city it comes from. Just what we need while facing down 2017's Breaking Armageddon. It is an interesting album. You know, it has a lot of textures and darkness, and I've said that word about 3 times now, so I'll stop. But
it's dark.
This is a great review of it that understands it, and I think that's worth a read.
I hadn't heard of JPEG Mafia, I must confess. I like to think it in an earlier age. He might have been on Folkways.
I don't know about that. With tracks with names like Bumbo Pussy Rasclat. So I'm not sure about...
It's just the folk music of its day, really.
It wasn't that difficult to get on.
There is a Folkways album, which is called something like, if you look at the Wikipedia page for Folkways, there's an album cover called sort of Gangland Chants or something. So one of the albums, they went and recorded gangs kind of essentially doing their sort of thing, you know. And
there's nothing.
Yeah.
This is my fucking pod. This is my fucking city, bitch. Fuck out me,
And then lastly, just because I thought it was funny, it's James Blunt in the How We Made series talking about how they made You're Beautiful, which, of course, was a massive hit. Massive, massive hit. He's talking to Dave Simpson in 2020. But actually, James Blunt is quite funny and quite self-aware. If you look at his Twitter feed, you'll see that he delights in just, you know, mocking himself and mocking other people that seem to, you know, want to mock him. And he's quite honest about You're Beautiful. It's portrayed as a romantic song, but it's actually a bit creepy. It's about a guy, me, stalking someone else's girlfriend while high. It's funny. Fair enough. It's a funny article. You know, the song is the song. Everyone knows it, and it is a sort of simpering, kind of sickly sweet thing. But actually, it has that sort of creepy undertone that James Blunt talks about quite bluntly and quite funnily. So that was my last thing that I wanted to mention.
The blunt James Blunt.
Indeed.
You're going to finish this tremendous episode where we've talked about... You're going to finish with James Blunt, are you? In all seriousness.
You have really loads of tone.
That's based
off. You have really loads of tone.
But actually, this is going to lower the tone even more. I was forced to watch Celebrity Bake Off with him in it, and he was quite endearingly self-deprecating, I must confess. I couldn't sort of hate him. He was quite sweet. And he won this, I think. Anyway, this is all really letting the whole episode down, I think.
No, I just had to mention it.
Yeah, no, it's great. It's great. You're beautiful. and he's beautiful. And we're all too beautiful.
Well, you guys are incredible. You know, I mean, spend an hour with you guys. You really know your stuff. It's incredible. What fun. I mean, what more joy could there be?
I'm so glad.
It's been lovely. It's been wonderful having you on the podcast. It's been really great.
On this family show, you've been one of our greatest guests.
Yes, this family show. We're going to have to cut a lot of that stuff out.
It'll be about 10 minutes long, I think, once Jasper's done the edit. But James, honestly, thank you so much for coming in.
Yes, thank you.
Well, thank you.
And good luck with what I know. At some point, there's this book you've done with Damien Hirst, which is supposed to be coming out for about 10 years now.
Yeah, he's fiddling around with it. He's revising his life every day.
Revising or rewriting?
Well, he's revising and then with a view to rewriting.
Good luck with all your...
Sometime between now and infinity, I expect this book to appear.
Good luck with all your future endeavours and projects. And, you know, we've just had such a ball talking with you. And, you know, we'll see you again soon, I hope. And I think that's probably it, isn't it? We're going to say goodbye. We'll be back next week without a guest. Hoping for a guest in a couple of weeks. But the original troika, the power trio of Rock's Back Pages... We'll be back without a guest next week, and we'll hope that you will tune in then. So, bye.
Thanks for listening.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye-bye.
Where have all the flowers gone? Long time passing.
I used to call Folkways a two-horse operation. He and Marion Dissler both working like horses. And I wasn't going to complain if people didn't get royalties, because here was a job that was being done and it needed to be done, and nobody else was doing it. No government in the world was doing it, no capitalist government, no socialist government, no museum. They claimed to do it. The Library of Congress claimed that they had a piddling small catalog compared to Folkways. Musée de l'Homme in Paris claims to be doing it, but they have a piddling small catalog compared to Folkways. All these big multi-million dollar operations were inching along, but Mo was just galloping along, doing the job that needed to be done. I'm not going to complain.
Oh, when will you ever learn?
That was Pete Seeger in conversation with Tony Sherman in 1987, concluding this week's Rock's Back Pages podcast. Many thanks to special guest James Fox. Visit his website at jamesfox.co.uk. The hosts were Barney Hoskins and Mark Pringle, and it was co-hosted and produced by Jasper Murison Bowie. The Rock's Back Pages podcast is part of the Pantheon Podcast Network.
You can find thousands of articles, as well as hundreds of full-length audio interviews at rocksbackpages.com.
You're beautiful. You're beautiful. You're beautiful. It's true.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.